Good evening, everyone, and welcome back to The Flicks the Church Forgot. I'm Peter Laws, and it's good to be able to continue this exploration of the Frankenstein myth, particularly looking at some of the classic horror movies that explore it. In the last episode, if you remember, I was looking at the two James Whale Frankenstein films, which are among the best, which is Frankenstein from 1931 and Bride of Frankenstein from 35. And I was originally only going to focus on those two films until I decided to broaden the scope a little, just because my newfound appreciation for this Frankenstein story made me want to dig into a few other films in the genre. And so another one that's important to look at is Hammer's Curse of Frankenstein from 1957.
What do you think of it?
It's horrible. Paul, the features are not important. What matters is I'm creating a being that will live and breathe. Once the scars on the face heal, it won't look so bad.
Victor, I appeal to you. Stop what you're doing before it's too late.
But what am I doing? I'm harming nobody. Just robbing a few graves. Then what doctor or scientist doesn't? How else are we to learn the complexities of the human animal?
Doctors rob for the eventual good of mankind. This can never end in anything but evil.
Now, why do you say that?
Now, this stars Peter Cushing, and it's been out on Blu-ray since last year, and so I picked up that edition and watched it recently, and good fun it was too. Here it's the same sort of story as the 31 version of Frankenstein, but with some interesting alterations. Baron Frankenstein is a young orphan boy who hires a tutor to teach him about science, and he eventually grows even more brilliant than his teacher, and the two begin a journey into raising dead dogs and then ultimately creating life from parts. Now, this version of the story is notable for a number of reasons. Firstly, it does what the original Frankenstein did in the early 30s by upping the horror to a level previously unseen, or maybe even thought about. Here, in the Hammer version, we've got dead dogs' corpses floating in fluid, extracted eyeballs lolling through a magnifying glass into the screen, gunshot wounds spurting bright blood, and severed heads being dumped in vats of acid. Yeah, it's pretty extreme. For the time at least. It's got a cruel streak too. The moment when the creature meets the blind man in Universal's Bride of Frankenstein is a tender and heartwarming moment. Not here though. In this one, the creature runs into another blind man, but do they have a smoke and drink and toast tearfully to finding a companion? Nah, in the Hammer version, the creature just kills the guy. I guess he isn't really into the whole friend thing. So there is more gore and obvious violence in Hammer's rendition. Again, maybe today's torture porn audiences would giggle at the inoffensiveness of it all now, but I think that's being naive to what is being represented here, because when you really think about it, it is dark and horrific. And it's interesting again that once more, it is the story of Frankenstein which pushed horror into a new realm of cinematic terror, or at least explicitness. In glorious, lurid colour, this film certainly put Hammer on the map and set the tone for their subsequent horror factory. But horror films themselves owe a genesis of sorts to both this and the original Frankenstein, for films that so unflinchingly gaze at death. It could even be argued that the Frankenstein story pushed horror even further with the seminal 80s film Reanimator that we'll look at in a moment. I guess the bottom line of my argument is saying, I found it interesting when you look at the paradigm shifts in cinematic explicitness and horror, it's interesting to see that it's the story of Frankenstein that is so often at the heart of breaking through those barriers. Now, the star of Curse of Frankenstein is undoubtedly Peter Cushing, as Frankenstein himself. He plays the Baron in a remarkably different way from Colin Clive's portrayal. Clive was more manic and sometimes hysterical, and not least, Clive's Baron had a massive conscience that reared its head once the creature started murdering people. As I guess you would have that, I suppose. But Cushing, on the other hand, is far more out there and dangerous. In the film, we're first presented with him as a teenager, and he's a wide-eyed, eager beaver wanting to absorb knowledge. And it's a cunning move showing him as a kid. Because while for the majority of the film we see the Baron as an adult, I think Cushing somehow brilliantly retains this childlike wonder at everything that follows. And there's this weirdly endearing naivety at what he's dabbling with. For example, in the opening scenes, Frankenstein and his teacher, Paul Kremp, raise a dog from the dead. And afterwards, over brandy, they're enthusiastically discussing what their next step will be. Now, Kremp is really quite reasonable. He's excited to share this work with the world. After all, think of all the good it would do the world to be able to return the dead to life. And thinking about it, that is surely the most crowd-pleasing scientific idea. What would you prefer? That they discover tomorrow in science, how to create life from nothing, or how to resurrect the dead back to full health? I think it would be the latter that most people would desire. Bring my dead wife back, please. That's more preferable than creating some other random new thing. And cramped scientific vision therefore seems quite sensible, or natural. Yet the Baron quickly reveals that the idea of raising the dead, it's just like blah blah to him. He wants to move straight on to raising parts. And not only parts, he wants to knit those parts together to create a patchwork human. Now Kremp is quite likely confused by this. He's like, what's so great about that? You know, I mean, maybe it's worth exploring, I suppose, but women and men have been creating new life throughout the centuries through the process of pregnancy. You know, it's reanimating of the dead, which really is the real headline grabber. And this is similar to what's going to crop up in Frankenstein, the true story that we're going to look at in a moment too. But no, in this, Frankenstein is insistent. He wants to create life. And this is what I love about Cushing's version, you see. He is so fixed on this idea that he will do anything to achieve it. He'll rob graves, he'll cut down the corpses of hanging thieves, he might even murder, he will lie. And the brilliance of it is that he is so blinking sociopathic about it. He doesn't seem to see any issue in what he's doing. Kremp gets increasingly unhappy and spends most of the film moaning about it. To be honest, Kremp gets well annoying after a while. You feel like saying, look, Paul, he's not going to do what you say, so just like get lost or leave him alone. But while Kremp keeps saying this awful, ungodly act can only end in evil, Frankenstein's constantly looking back at Kremp and saying like, huh? What you talk about, Willis? You know, he just doesn't see any drawbacks to his plan at all. At one point, Kremp discovers the Baron is hovering with his scalpel above a corpse, and he looks at him with disgust. You know, you are mutilating a corpse. And the Baron looks up and he's like, mutilating? I've removed his brain. Mutilating has nothing to do with it. It just doesn't seem any issue. Later, Kremp threatens the Baron at one point and says, if you don't stop this experiment, then I'll tell your fiancé about what you're doing. And it's like Kremp thinks he's dealt the killer blow, but Cushing just sort of shrugs with a smile and says, yeah, cool, bring her in so she can see. What harm can it do? I mean, that sort of dedication, that you murder and steal and cut up dead bodies in your attic and you think your wife and friends might think it's all good, is as chilling as it is weirdly admirable, at least within the context of fiction. So Cushing's utterly focused character is brilliantly drawn, and it's actually one of my favourite portrayals of the Baron. He goes through such an arc in this that, and I don't want to give the ending away, but it ends in such a way that it felt desperately cruel and unfair how this story concludes. And it just left me thinking once again, wow, Kremp, you are a dick. I just didn't like him. That's testament, I think, to the script and the acting that turns Baron Frankenstein into this sort of anti-hero. Christopher Lee is in this, and of course the monster that he plays in the makeup is great on the first reveal. With that speeded up zoom into the ripping away of the bandage to show a cut up ashen face with one huge cataract ridden eye lolling out. But, you know, it's like, whoa, that's pretty intense. But really, quite soon after, you start to realize that the makeup is not nearly as subtle or powerful as the Karloff makeup. It's somehow less smooth. It's weirdly less modern for a film that was made long after the original Frankenstein. And you can imagine that Karloff isn't actually wearing any makeup at all. It's all blended so well. Especially when Karloff took out his dental plate so his cheek would naturally sink into itself. At least he did that in the first one. He had to keep his plate in the second one because they made him talk. But Christopher Lee here, well, he looks like Christopher Lee with some face putty on when you really look at it. It's not terrible by any means, but I guess I think it's no mistake that in popular culture you will still find that people will think of Jack Pierce's Frankenstein image rather than the Phil Leakey one in this Hammer rendition. To be fair, Leakey had a challenge anyway because he had to make his monster look notably different from the Universal one for copyright reasons. But still, I think it's not hard to see which makeup is the most profound and connecting. It's Pierce's. In all, The Curse of Frankenstein might not be as profound or as moving as the Universal offerings, but it is thoroughly good fun, and it's a great, enjoyable gothic romp, which, while disgusting many critics of the time, actually went on to be a smash hit at the box office for Hammer, and in many ways kicked off the gothic horror revival in cinema across the world. The Lionsgate Blu-ray apparently hasn't got the best picture quality, and one look at the Amazon reviews has a host of people dissing this transfer, including a cinema projectionist who showed the film at the time of its release. He said that, you know, this transfer is not very good. But having said all that, the disc is worth seeing for some really excellent special features, not least a short piece called Life with Sir, which is a 12-minute interview with Peter Cushing's longtime secretary Joyce Broughton. The Sir in the title being the name by which Peter was often affectionately known by his friends. I tell you, this is one of the most moving extras to a film I've seen. Joyce talks about, with great honesty and affection, about Cushing and how he struggled with his grief at the loss of his wife. At one point, she talks about how she would often just hold Peter Cushing so he could cry. She states, you know, there's nothing sexual or nothing untoward about it. He just desperately missed his wife so much and needed someone close, and he felt this grief for the rest of his life. He lost his wife at a fairly young age. I've spoken on Cushing's grief in a previous episode, it's just quite a moving idea. And then she goes on to talk about Peter Cushing as he died and the legacy he left behind, not just the cinematic one, but the personal one. And I just felt it was a really lovely piece and gives you a portrait of an earnest, kind and thoughtful gentleman in amongst all the gore and the horror. The Curse of Frankenstein, however you get to see it, is definitely recommended.
Oh, Mr. West, I'm actually glad to see you. It saves me the trouble of having to send for you.
You'll never get credit for my discovery. Who's going to believe a talking head? Get a job in a sideshow.
Okay, so it's not strictly Frankenstein, but indulge me for a moment for briefly including Stuart Gordon's neon burst of creative genius, which is Reanimator. This is based on the fun and pulpy series of stories from the mighty H.P. Lovecraft, and it's a Frankenstein tale with a lot less German names in it, where a young doctor, Herbert West, is perfecting his Day-Glow reanimation serum for bringing back the dead. Now, like Cushing's Baron in Curse of Frankenstein, he brings back a domestic pet and then gets a hankering for experimenting with parts. In the prologue, West is accused of murdering his mentor, Dr. Gruber, and to which he straightens his shoulders and shouts boldly, "I gave him life!" Yeah, this is Frankenstein, all right, but in the mold of ultra-high-energy MTV conversant excess. Add to that a genuine sense of scares sometimes, outlandish gore and some laugh-out-loud moments, and you really get one of the great horror movies of the 1980s. And I'm really looking forward to seeing it on Blu-ray when I think it gets released in the UK later in the year. A great soundtrack from Richard Band too. But yeah, I just wanted to quickly mention Reanimator because I think it certainly is natural to say it in the same breath as Frankenstein. But moving back to Frankenstein proper, as it were, I'd like to review the upcoming release of a 70s TV movie called, or TV miniseries rather, called Frankenstein: The True Story.
The new science offers power. And power terrifies them.
What kind of power?
Power over death.
Frankenstein: The True Story is about to be released in the UK for the first time on the 10th of March 2014 from Second Sight. Now, sadly, it's not a Blu-ray, only DVD, but don't let that put you off, because it's a really enjoyable 181-minute version of the Frankenstein tale. Now, don't let the subtitle confuse you, however. This might be billed as Frankenstein: The True Story, but I'm not sure by which standard they are judging this by. If they mean it is a true version of the novel, then they are stretching it a bit, because the TV movie might incorporate lots of the novel's ideas, and including characters like Henry Clavell and the location of the North Pole. But on the whole, this is just a mashup of the ideas from Shelley's novel. No matter, though, it's still an absorbing piece of gothic retro television. And I do love 1970s TV horror movies, and so it's great to see Frankenstein presented in this sort of long-form format. Here, Dr. Frankenstein is played by a man called Leonard Whiting, who did very little else after this, but was perhaps most famous for playing Romeo in Zeffirelli's Romeo and Juliet a few years before. Now, he struggles to come to terms with the death of his brother, who drowns at the very start of the film. In fact, the film dives straight into this really quickly, and I thought I was missing something. I thought maybe there was another episode beforehand, but no, I think they just dive straight in. The brother drowns, and Frankenstein is not content to accept that his death could be the end. And after his brother's funeral, he has this intense exchange with his fiancée Elizabeth just outside the church, and Frankenstein is railing against death and how he wishes he could create life. And Elizabeth gives him a little look and says something like, "My darling," she says, we can make life when we are man and wife. In other words, they could have a baby. And Frankenstein's rather harsh answer is actually a helpful insight into his character and the motivation of all of the Frankensteins. She says they can make life, to which he says, "And so can a pair of animals. Life out of life, that's no miracle. But life out of death, out of my brother's corpse, ... Well, that seems to be quite another matter. He ends up meeting a like-minded doctor called Clavel, and the two of them end up following through on this quest to bring life out of death. Now, what's interesting about this version, and I think there is a Hammer version of Frankenstein out there too that does this, maybe the Revenge of Frankenstein, I can't quite remember, it's that the creature is born, so to speak, not as some lumbering, hideous monster, but as actually a handsome, beautiful man. That's not really giving the plot away, as this is the central idea of the film, and it's on some of the DVD covers even. But while he may begin beautiful, things don't necessarily remain that way, and so the creature becomes less wanted by its creator. Now, this is a theme directly out of Shelley's book, and is something seen clearly as well in the Universal Studio versions. And things, I think, really start to spice up when two new characters appear in the second part of the miniseries. The beautiful Jane Seymour, maybe most famous for Live and Let Die and Dr. Quinn Medicine Woman, although I always remember her from Battlestar Galactica, she crops up in this, playing a really interesting and unusual part, and she really gets her teeth into it. And also the mighty James Mason as Dr. Polidori is great. This Dr. Polidori is not a character in the book, and is more a riff on the Dr. Pretorius character in The Bride of Frankenstein. And while Mason's character doesn't quite have that immediate quirky camp threat about him as Pretorius does, he really is a lot of fun, and James Mason is just fantastic, and that voice of his is perfect, sort of gleefully moving through events, treating others like crap and then snorting laughs into his leather gloves. It's like, Mr. Stricker on ecstasy. The creature is played by Michael Sarrazin, who actually puts in quite a moving performance in this. I don't know if I'm just reading into this, but I do think it seems quite obvious to me, at least, that they were hinting at some sort of homoerotic charge going on between the creature and Frankenstein. Or at the very least, they love one another and can appreciate each other's beauty. They certainly say as much as that. So that as their relationship starts to deteriorate in the film, there is this genuine sense of loss and heartache that comes. In fact, there is this moment when the creature starts to realize that it's all falling apart, and as he looks in the mirror and he starts to groan at the changes he can see, he's like going, "Oh no, oh no, no." As Victor Frankenstein looks on, and he's similarly devastated, and I just thought it was a really powerful moment. In fact, my immediate thought was that this must be what it's like for a couple who have to cope with one of them contracting an illness. You know, we know that every day people are diagnosed with disease and then have to cope with what it does to them, not just mentally but physically. And of course the partner and the family have to deal with this. And that sense of devastation, that loss of self, the rebellion of the body against us, as David Cronenberg might well put it, I thought that moment in Frankenstein, the true story, got to the heart of what that must feel like. The shock and the terror and the depression of things not staying as they are. Reading up on the internet, there seems to be one scene in particular in Frankenstein, the true story, which seemed to scare people as kids when they watched it back in the early 70s. I won't tell you what happens, but it takes place at a ball, and though it's hardly shocking by today's standards, within the context of this time in this story, it was pretty out there, and I can totally get why children would have struggled to sleep after seeing it. The sets and the costumes are sumptuous, the acting is pretty much uniformly great, though I guess at a push I would say there were times when Leonard Whiting as the Victor Frankenstein, I thought he lacked a bit of presence. But weaving its way through all of this is a superb music score by Gil Melly. He was a jazz musician who also did various scores, especially in the 1970s, and I guess he's most famous for his score to Steven Spielberg's Duel. But I love his work. I mean, I love that score, but I love his work on this TV work like Columbo and Night Gallery and The Night Stalker, Kolchak. All that stuff is just brilliant. And his electronic experimental work that he did on Michael Crichton's The Andromeda Strain, that's a really cool album. The score that he puts in here for Frankenstein the True Story is brooding and beautiful and at times really quite unsettling. I don't know what it is about certain sounding flute arrangements, but they just creep me out. So do check this out when it's released in March. Apparently it's going to be Region 2, sadly, but I can't confirm that as I only had a screener copy from the company. But besides, I think the DVD is available in the US already. Included on the disc is a fun little time capsule of an extra, which has James Mason in modern day walking around in his suit saying, "I am Dr. Polidori. You will meet me along with many other intriguing characters in an upcoming sumptuous production of Frankenstein. You will be transported to elegant England. You will thrill at the gothic heart of Shelley's masterpiece, Shelley who lies here in this grave." And the camera cuts to a fake gravestone with her name on it. Fake because I don't even think she was ever even buried in London, but still, it's a cool little bizarre extra, and James Mason is always good value. Definitely recommend seeing Frankenstein, the True Story. So then, we've been talking about Frankenstein, and I've looked at just a mere handful of films about him. There are lots more, and so don't electrocute me just because I missed out your favourite. But reviewing these films is really only scratching the surface. So let me encourage you to join me next time as we throw ourselves deeper into the theological, sociological, cultural pool, as we explore what themes we might find in these films. Are they just horror films? Are the Universal movies, especially Bride of Frankenstein, a subtext for homosexual identity? Do they really challenge the traditional idea of God like those early church critics thought? And what, if anything, might Frankenstein teach us about the nature of evil? All that and more in the next episode. But until then, don't forget the flicks the church forgot.